From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a talk with André Debus III about his new novel and his relationship with his father, the celebrated writer André Debus, who died earlier this year. André Debus III and his brother built their father's coffin and buried him on his land. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews The Mountain, a tribute to Bill Monroe by Steve Earle and the bluegrass group The Del McCoury Band. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Tornadoes ripped through parts of Kansas and Oklahoma last night, wiping out entire neighborhoods and leaving 43 people dead. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports from Moore, Oklahoma.
Today, dozens of people walked up and down the main street in Moore, Oklahoma, trying to get closer to the neighborhood where a half-mile-wide tornado flattened homes and businesses last night. Corrugated metal roofing hangs from light posts, and entire blocks are destroyed. Some residents were allowed to collect what belongings they could, old photographs and trophies, or a few mud-soiled clothes. They described hovering in hallways, bathrooms, and storm cellars last night as a string of deadly twisters cut through the Oklahoma City metro area. Authorities are restricting access to some of the hardest-hit areas, where the smell of natural gas fills the air and downed power lines still dangle from their poles. Most described last night's storms as the worst they've experienced. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Moore, Oklahoma.
Air raid sirens sounded again in Belgrade on the 42nd night of the NATO air campaign. Parts of Yugoslavia are still without power after NATO wrecked an important power grid serving Belgrade and the surrounding area. NATO spokesman Jamie Shea said that good weather over the Balkans allowed NATO to carry out its most successful military operation against field forces in Kosovo, striking Yugoslav tanks, artillery, and military equipment. NATO also says 90% of Kosovo's 1.5 million residents have been expelled from their homes or have fled from the battered province. But NATO says its air campaign is succeeding and it has no reason to change strategy. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Brussels.
800,000 have fled Kosovo. Another 650,000 are roaming their native province in extreme hardship. 100,000 men of military age are missing. There are reports of mass executions in 65 towns and villages. Outgoing NATO Military Committee Chief General Klaus Naumann said NATO is nibbling away at the ability of President Slobodan Milosevic's troops to conduct such operations. He ruled out a ground offensive to bolster Allied efforts. Naumann said the nature of coalition warfare had deprived the alliance of two key elements, surprise and overwhelming force. He admitted the air campaign had not worked as quickly as some would like. But we have a lot of patience, Naumann said. This is Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Brussels.
President Clinton is on his way to Europe for briefings by NATO officials on the six-week-old bombing campaign against Yugoslavia. On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 131 points to close at 10,883. Declines led advances by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR News. General Motors says car and truck sales dropped 4.2% during the month of April. GM's numbers come one day after other auto companies reported sales increases. NPR's Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
Some analysts had predicted that GM sales would be flat or even down a bit for April, but they didn't expect such a sizable drop. Chevrolet division sales were off by more than 10% alone. The decline is especially disappointing for GM when you consider that just a day earlier, Ford recorded a nearly 7% sales increase for the month, while Daimler Chrysler saw a 2% improvement in sales of its Chrysler line of vehicles. All companies are still selling a lot of trucks and sport utility vehicles. Part of GM's problem is that it can't build enough of them. Analysts do say that overall, the state of the U.S. vehicle market remains positive, given a continuing robust economy and strong consumer confidence numbers. Don Gagne, NPR News, Detroit.
The index of leading economic indicators rose in March, suggesting that the economy will keep expanding for the next 6 to 9 months. The Conference Board, a private research group, said the index gained 0.1%, growing for the sixth month in a row. The index has grown by 1.6% since last September. The index is calculated from 10 different economic statistics, including the unemployment rate, stock prices, and the money supply. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 131 points to close at 10,883. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost 50 points, or nearly 2%, to close at 2,485. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Andre Debuse III, has been described as a remarkable and distinctive writer, who is the son of a remarkable and distinctive writer. Andre Debuse III had a new novel published earlier this year. Sadly, the publication coincided with the sudden death of his father, Andre Debuse, of a heart attack at the age of 62. As you may know, Debuse Sr. was an award-winning writer who had lost one leg and lost all use of the other in a freak car accident in 1986. We invited Andre Debuse III to talk with us about his new novel and to share some memories of his father. Let's start with the new novel, which is called House of Sand and Fog. It's about two people from two cultures who have claim to the same house, a house which is about all they possess. Kathy is a house cleaner and recovering drug addict who inherited her father's house. It's taken away from her by the county for not paying back taxes that she was mistakenly charged. By the time the error is corrected, Kathy has been evicted and her home has been sold to an Iranian, a former colonel in the Shah's army. For him, the home represents his chance for regaining the dignity he feels he and his family have lost as struggling immigrants. The colonel is ashamed to be working on a highway cleanup crew and at a convenience store. This passage from the new novel will give you a sense of how he sees America. The colonel is sitting on a bench watching people pass by.
I hear the speech of Orientals, Greeks, Germans, and French. But the majority are the more large, more fed, pink-in-the-face Americans who carry their shopping bags, eating ice cream cones, or drinking sweet sodas from cups as they walk past their small, loud children leading them. I sit and I regard these cows, these radishes, and I again think to myself, these people do not deserve what they have. When I first came to these United States, I expected to see more of the caliber of men I met in my business dealings in Tehran, the disciplined gentlemen of the American military, the usually fit and well-dressed executives of the defense industry, their wives who were perfect hostesses in our most lavish homes. And of course, the films and television programs imported from here showed to us only successful people. They were all attractive to the eye. They dressed in the latest fashion. They drove new automobiles and were forever behaving like ladies and gentlemen, even when sinning against their God. But I was quite mistaken, and this became to me clear in only 1 week of driving my family up and down this West Coast. Yes, there is more wealth here than anywhere in the world. Every market has all items well stocked at all times. And there is Beverly Hills and more places like it. But so many of the people live in homes not much more colorful than airbase housing. Furthermore, those late nights I have driven back to the Pooldar apartment in Berkeley after working, I have seen in the windows of the pale blue glow of at least one television in every home. And I am told that many family meals are eaten in front of that screen as well. And perhaps this explains the face of Americans, the eyes that never appear satisfied, at peace with their work, or the day God has given them. These people have the eyes of very small children who are forever looking for the next source of distraction, entertainment, or a sweet taste in the mouth. And it is no longer to me a surprise that it is the recent immigrants who excel in this land, the Orientals, the Greeks, and yes, the Persians. We know rich opportunity when we see it.
I'm wondering how you came up with the way that the colonel sees Americans.
Well, Terry, I guess I can answer that most honestly by talking a little bit about my writing process. For me, it's really, I think the whole reason I do it is because I don't know what I'm doing, and I feel my imagination is pulled to a situation or to a sliver of an image or to a character, and I really write it to find out. And so I based the Colonel situation on a man I knew. He was the father of a friend of mine and from college, and he was a colonel in the Shah's Air Force, and his life did fall apart after leaving that corrupt regime. And I had an image in my head. I was visiting him, and I saw him working two jobs and disguising what he was doing, hiding that really from people in the building where he lived. And I was, you know, I was struck by it, and it never left for 15 years, that image of his sort of sallow-faced body in the elevator with groceries at the end of a 16-hour day stuck with me, and I've never been able to let go of it.
When you said that you watched him disguise what he was doing, the character in your book does a lot of manual labor, but he dresses in a very expensive fine suit to leave the house so people will think he's got a fine job, and then he changes in a hotel or in a restroom along the way to work and puts on his working clothes.
Yeah, I lifted that right from life. But it should be said that the man who I based this on is not remotely like that, and I discovered a whole new character. But yeah, you know, the writer Alice Munro calls those sorts of moments starter dough. we then bake with all these other ingredients in there and see what comes out.
Well, you know, the colonel in the passage that you just read sees Americans as cows who just take for granted the good things that they have and, you know, live kind of slothful lives and don't appreciate the important values. And I wonder what, if anything, you share with his point of view.
Well, I don't share that view. Is that the honest thing to say? This is a way to answer it. I once read something by Alexander Solzhenitsyn that never left my mind about how we Westerners are lacking in the kind of character that those who've lived under communism and totalitarian regime are spared. I mean, they're spared this lack of character, that basically our lives are so easy, we've really been infantilized, if that's a word. We've been made children, and we're lacking the sort of, character that people in tougher situations have. You know, there's a really wonderful essay I teach in my writing classes from the writer Flannery O'Connor called The Nature and Aim of Fiction. And in it, she says so many brilliant things in this essay, but one of the things she said is that our beliefs are not what we see, talking about we writers, but the light by which we see. So that's a real mysterious terrain, and I don't know where it all leads for me. But I do believe that there might be something of my own view in there, although it's a lot harsher and more severe and really clearer for the colonel than for me.
What inspired the idea of two people who have claim to the same place, the same house, who both desperately need it?
Well, you know, I know a lot of writers share this this little technique I have. I get a lot of good story ideas from newspapers, especially your local or national news briefs, where they just have a really scant little paragraph that presents the situation but gives you no detail. So your imagination really gets hungry for the detail. And my first writing class I ever taught was in 1990 at Emerson College, and I had never taken a writing class, and I didn't know how to teach one. So I'll get them started the way I start. So I brought in a newspaper and pointed to some news sections, and one of them was about a woman in Oakland who had her house evicted for failure to pay back taxes she did not owe. And when they admitted their mistake, the county who had evicted her, they had already sold it, and now the men who bought it legally didn't have to give it back. That was actually in the newspaper clipping, and I told my students, one of you guys should write about this. This is pretty interesting. And nobody did, but it never left my imagination either. But after finishing my second book 3 years later, I started to write myself into that. But it didn't come together, Terry, until I had been trying to write about the colonel situation for years too, and I thought, well, maybe it'll just be a poem about a guy in an elevator. I mean, maybe it'll be a short essay. I don't know what it'll be. It doesn't seem to be want to be fiction. But then I actually noticed in the newspaper clipping that I had kept that the man who bought the house had a Middle Eastern name. And while I think it was probably Arabic and not Iranian, it did get me, the old little, you know, the writer light bulb went off, and I thought, what if my colonel bought that house? And then it took off, and, you know, 4 years later, it was done.
The point of view in your novel keeps shifting between the colonel and Kathy. And so you're writing in each of their first-person voices. Mm. And this requires you writing in the character of two people who are very different from you, and you're doing this at a time when some people get very angry if they think a writer is presuming that he or she is capable of understanding someone who is of a different race or ethnic group or gender. And I'm wondering if...
I'm so glad you're bringing this up.
I'm wondering if you feel that this is a loaded time to be writing in the voices of an Iranian colonel and a woman.
Especially when I'm a white guy?
Yeah, right.
I think, yes.
That's the way it usually goes, right? White guys aren't allowed to do this. Yeah,
I know, and I completely... I think I understand the intent behind the anger behind all of this. And while I completely am with that anger, and we're looking at, you know, thousands of years of patriarchy and imperialism and genocide, that's what's actually caused this anger. And I'm no small audience. I mean, I listen to that and share in that rage, actually. But the fact is, I think culturally we are deeply misled when we begin to go after writers who are doing this. The fact of the matter is, it is our job. It's not just an interesting thing to do. It's the very job description of the writer, is to imagine the lives of others. And I think the writer Rose Ellen Brown really put this all to rest for me. She articulated it really well, I think. She said that, you know, when the writer puts him or herself in the shoes of the other, you know, for instance, a white male writing from the point of view of a dark-skinned man or a woman, etc., that far from it's, this is not an act of colonialism. Actually, because it's an act of empathy, it's inherently an act of friendship. Now, the danger, of course, is that the writer can fall flat on his or her face and get it completely wrong. And I think that's where the risk should lie. I mean, we should be able to take that risk, and we should, you know, oftentimes we fail. But nothing risked, nothing gained. I truly believe that the imagination is huge. And if I get on my little high horse for a second, I do think that we live in a time that's suspicious of the imagination. I mean, I think that's why TV talk shows are so big, and I think that's why memoirs are so big, and I think that's why true life crime shows are so big. I don't know what's going on, but somehow we don't trust the imaginative work as much as we did even 20 years ago when I was in college.
You teach. Do you find that to be true with students also?
Mm-hmm. I do, especially, well, younger ones, those 18, 19, 20 years old, who, you know, are wonderful young people. You know, there's all sorts of hope for the future from my little vantage point in classrooms every semester. But I do think that we have been shaped by that tube in all of our homes. And I think maybe that did come out in the Iranian's point of view. But that television, I think, has done a number on us in ways that I can't even put my finger on yet. But there is this impatience with, I'm seeing with 19-year-olds who I teach, to get to the heart of it, to get to it. And it isn't necessarily an imaginal textual experience so much as give me the facts, give me the numbers, give me the bottom line, give me the it. And it's kind of a drive-through. Drive-by way of looking at it.
The express line.
Yeah, you know, and you know, they're products of this time, but and they're wonderful young people. But it is different from just when I was in school in the late 70s. I feel a real difference.
My guest is writer Andre Debuse III. His new novel is called House of Sand and Fog. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Andre Debuse III, and his new novel is called House of Sand and Fog. In understanding the lives of your characters, does it help that you've done a lot of different things so far in the course of your life? You've held, for instance, a lot of different jobs, from house cleaning to bounty hunter.
Weird, huh? Yeah. That bounty hunter thing was a one-weekend job. Throughout my 20s, I roamed. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I got a degree in general liberal arts, and and then just fled and just roamed the country. And I began to write early on, and I had a hunch that was part of what I was going to be doing, but I was also interested in acting, and I just felt this vague sort of passionate need to experience. And I don't think I kept a job more than 6 months, which is why I did so many things in the course of about 8 or 9 years. But yeah, to answer your question, I think it's absolutely helped. I did go to Mexico to look for a killer, you know, for some law enforcement agencies. But, you know, I was 22 and I think just chasing adventure. But again, if I can quote Flannery O'Connor, whose work I really admire, and this essay I teach all the time, she says that the job of the writer is not to be immersed in experience, but to contemplate it, to reflect upon it. And I think that's right on. That the imagination really, you don't have to leave your backyard to write great things. And so, but it doesn't hurt. The short answer is it can never hurt. It's good work if you can get it, but you don't. I get nervous when 19, 20, 30-year-old even writers think they have to go to the bar room and you know, get stabbed to have something to write about. No, you don't. No, you don't.
Well, that said, tell me something about that weekend you were a bounty hunter.
Well, I was working with a private investigator. We were working corrections together. I was his assistant, and I was running the show sometimes, and we went off on these trips. He's a very interesting guy. He was really a healer, and he would heal people he worked on. So he would turn them into authorities and then do counseling on them and heal them. It was a really fascinating situation. But we were tracking down, I have to stay really vague about this out of safety for myself and my family, but we were tracking down a guy who was very dangerous, and I had a fake name, a pseudonym, and we went to a lot of gay bars in Mexico looking for him. And I was 22 years old and naive, and I got a real eye-opening experience about that subculture and spent a lot of time going to gay bars. I'm trying not to feel self-conscious. I thought I was a young white male, but I was getting so much big manly male attention, it confused me. What is it about me that, you know, people do that? So for me, it was less frightening in terms of guns and knives and killings, which was all afoot. It was more frightening about all the homosexual stuff. You know, I was 22 and repressed. So it was an interesting experience and actually very moving, because I saw poverty like I'd never seen. You know, I grew up in, you know, some, you know, fairly depressed areas in the Northeast, mill towns. And, you know, I thought I grew up in some tough, well, you know, neighborhoods. And really, they don't even come close to the poverty of, quote unquote, third world places. And that really affected me. I saw some really devastated families, actually.
My guest is Andre Dubuc III. His new novel is called House of Sand and Fog. I was very sorry to hear about the death of your father recently. Had he been sick, or was this just an out-of-the-blue thing?
No, it was just one of those terrible sudden deaths. He, you know, as you know, because you've interviewed him over the years, he was in a wheelchair the last 12 and a half years of his life, and that's not easy on anybody. But, you know, that notwithstanding, he was in pretty good physical shape. You know, my brother and his partner had built a really long straight ramp from his house just in the last few months, and my father did sprints on it in his wheelchair. In the summer, he swam laps in his pool. He shadow boxed and lifted weights. I mean, he took relatively good care of himself. So, you know, he was 62, and we didn't know. It was a shock. He got in the shower and had a heart attack and died.
Now, I understand that in his papers, he'd asked that you build his coffin, and you're one of the many things you do is you're a carpenter.
Mm.
What was your reaction when you found that out?
Well, it was not in his will at all. It actually came as my brother and I were busting his chops over, frankly, the last story he'd ever written called Sisters, which is coming out in, I think, in Book Magazine soon. It's a Western, and in the Western, the hero builds a coffin for a man and digs the grave and does it all in about 3.5 hours. And my father was a master writer, but he'd never worked with his hands. And my brother and I have always done this kind of work. And we really gave him grief for that, because there ain't no way you can build a box that can hold a 200-pound man in 3 hours, let alone with hand tools, and then dig a hole around trees with roots. So we really gave him, you know, a lot of heat for that, and we're having fun doing it out on his deck this past summer. And he said, well, when you build my coffin, you can take all the time you want, and I want it to be straight pine. And then we got into the discussion here, and he said, and I want to be buried on my land. And so that was just, you know, this past summer, and from busting his chops. And so I was on this book tour for this novel when I heard in San Francisco, and all I wanted to do was get back and hug my children and then go find my brother and build the coffin. And we did. We gathered the lumber store, my brother Jeb and me, and we designed it, you know, through tears. And it was a weird, just such a stark experience. And then bought the wood, spent about an hour picking it out in the lumber yard where we've been for years on jobs. Went to his shop, and from about 5 at night to 9 in the morning, we built my dad's coffin out of pine. And it was a beautiful night, though, I have to say. You know, it'd be like on a job. You know, we'd say, come on, what kind of a router is that? What kind of a, you know, a dado is that? Give me your router, let me show you how to do it. And then, there, you know, there'd be this, you know, masculine sparring. And then we'd be hugging each other and crying. And then we'd be ripping a piece of wood on the table saw and laughing and crying. And then there'd be these long moments of stillness and quiet. Over the course of the night, his friends would come by. You know, his longtime agent and friend, Philip Spitzer, and his brother, Michelle, came with their some family, and they just came and were there and took some pieces of wood with them when they left. And one of my father's priests came by about 3 in the morning, helped us sand, and then some friends came at dawn with beer and sandwiches. We took a break, and when it was finally done, I lay in the coffin and had him shut it so I could feel what it was like. And I was also honestly testing to see if the lid was the right height and there was enough curve to it. And then we dug the grave because we ended up buying a plot of land a half mile from my dad's house. And the farmer who we bought it from said that she hired her hands to dig it by shovel. She didn't have a backhoe. And when we heard that, we said, well, no, we'll be happy to dig it. If anybody's going to be digging this grave by hand, it'll be his sons. And so my brother Jeb and I and our good friend Bill Cantwell, who's like a third son to my father, we dug the grave. And the funny thing is it took 8 hours. So building the coffin with power tools took 2 men about 12 hours, and digging the grave with 3 men took 8 hours. So the veracity of that detail was off in that story.
So you were right to criticize your father.
Yeah, you need to redo that one.
Did he, by the way, redo it?
No, he didn't. He said, no, well, then there was sand near those roots, and he happened to have the tools. You know, he exercised, you know, he was so far along in the craft. He was such a master. He said, hey, screw, this is called poetic license. I don't know if he said that, but that's essentially what he did. He just put down the big staff and said, poetic license, move on.
Andre Debuse III. His new novel is called House of Sand and Fog. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. By Fox Searchlight Pictures and Regency Enterprises, presenting William Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, opening Friday, May 14th in theaters, on the web at foxsearchlight.com. And by Bantam Books, publisher of Running on Ritalin by Lawrence H. Diller, M.D., providing information on the drug millions of children are taking. Available in trade paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Andre Debuse III about his relationship with his father, writer Andre Debuse, who died earlier this year. And Ken Tucker reviews a new tribute album to Bill Monroe by Steve Earle and the bluegrass group the Del McCoury Band. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with writer Andre Debuse III. He has a new novel called House of Sand and Fog. The publication of his novel earlier this year coincided with the sudden death of his father, the award-winning writer Andre Debuse, of a heart attack at the age of 62. As many of our listeners know, your father lost his legs in a road accident back in 1986. He was helping people who had been hit by a car when he was hit by another oncoming car. I'm wondering how the accident affected your relationship with him.
Well, I think, you know, I'm the second oldest of his six children. I have an older sister, Suzanne, and then me, and then my brother, Jeb, my sister, Nicole, and then my two sisters, Cadence and Madeline, from my father's third marriage. And I think I can speak for all of them, because we've all talked about this, when I say that we all got closer. It's very hard to see anyone in your family suffer, and so that was hard, but not any hard. It was a lot harder for him. So I think the short answer, and I think hopefully the most honest answer, is we got closer in those 13 years, mainly because he was very focused on family in that last decade. Family and writing, I think, for a number of reasons. One, his writing had gotten to the point where he was making a living from it and didn't have to have another job. And he was raising his two young daughters who were still just 16 and 12. And no, that's not completely true. What happened, though, I think, and my father's written about this and talked about it, is something spiritual. He shifted into a higher spiritual gear, which I don't think just anybody would do, suffering a crippling. And consequently, he was a very present, focused father. And I'm just so grateful for all the times we've had in these last almost 13 years. I mean, he really should have been killed in 1986. He was run over at 58 miles an hour. He was standing on the road, got hit at 58 miles an hour. There's a quarter bent in half in his front pocket. So I personally just feel so grateful he was around another 12 and a half years. I want him around another 20. I am not ready for him to be gone, and I miss him terribly. We had some really, really wonderful talks and family times in the last 12 and a half years.
When he lost the ability to walk, did you have to figure out how much responsibility you were going to try to take for helping him get through those transitional periods when he was learning how to be a different person?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the whole family, I guess every family has to go through that sort of balancing act of who's going to take over here, who's going to take over there, and, you know, all families slip into their little pathologies.
Yeah, really.
The one who always does it, the one who never does. I'm not saying that happened to my family, but all that came to fruition. I'm grateful, too, that this happened at a time in my life where I wasn't nearly as busy. I mean, my wife and I are blessed with three young children now, and I work all sorts of jobs and write daily, and it would be a lot harder now to tend to him now. But when he was hurt, I was in my mid-20s, I was single, and you know, we all took turns kind of helping out. My dad and I used to lift weights together for years and run together. Actually, on his birthday every year, we'd run this 11-mile course near his house. He was a real athletic guy. And, you know, after a year of being sedentary and 11 operations and losing his leg, his body had atrophied terribly, so he was really weak. And for the first few years, I went over three times a week and set him up on the weight bench and set him up with some weights and put him through a program. And it was really a wonderful experience. I mean, it sounds self-absorbed to say that, but it was, you know, frankly, it just feels good when you can do something for somebody who you might at first judge as helpless. He wasn't helpless. He was severely compromised. Of course, he would hate that euphemism. He would say, hey, bull, man, I was crippled.
Right, right.
You know,
I remember him saying that.
Well, I'm the one. He was always very polite about protecting my identity, but I heard him say on some interview, it might have been with you, Terry, or might have been in print, that one of his family members was trying to talk him into, you know, a positive state of mind after being crippled, you know, and had told him, you know, Dad, maybe, you know, that thing they're calling them now, physically challenged, that was me. And boy, he let me have it. He said, no, man, you're physically challenged. You just ran up the stairs, you're breathing hard. Me, I'm crippled.
I remember him saying that.
Oh, I crept out of that room. Oh, he's right, he's right. Oh, shoot. I should have known. I'm a writer. I should hate euphemisms just as much.
After your father's accident, he went through a long and famous bout of writer's block. And I figure you were at that time an aspiring writer or an already published writer. And I'm wondering, as a writer, what it was like for you to watch him struggle with wanting to write and not being able to write for such a long period of time.
Well, I'm glad you asked, because I think there's been a public misperception. But he really did not stop writing. He was writing, and it just, the fiction was not coming. He was writing nonfiction all along, and he actually, I think, was writing well. What stopped, though, was fiction. And it was my sister, Nicole, who's a therapist and a teacher and writer out in California, who told him, you know, maybe you should not even put that on your imagination and just start writing about what's in front of you, which is being crippled, and write about that. The fiction took a hiatus, and I was there the day in his house when he finished a story called The Curse, which was later published in Playboy magazine. It's a really strong story, and I was there the day he finished writing it longhand, and he was weeping in his room, and my little sister Cadence, who was about five at the time, ran in, and he held her, and she was worried because he was crying and thought his leg might hurt because he spent all day with the leg propped up. He's in a lot of physical pain. And he cried and just said, "No, I've got it back. I've got it back. Go tell Peggy, his wife, I've got it back." And so to answer your question, I don't know if I was looking at him. I was too personally involved as his son to even think about writing. I just saw my father getting his work back, and I really didn't think about my own struggles with the craft much, I don't think. I don't remember thinking much about writing and getting hurt. Because I did not see him, you know, honestly, what it was his days were full and nights were full of trying to get through the physical pain and learn to get his mobility back. And everything fell to the wayside, including writing. So I think I thought about it very little as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, once when you were asked about the difference between your father's writing and your writing, you said that you think one of the reasons why your father's work is more affirming is that even with characters who don't have God, their story is told from the point of view of a writer who does believe in God, whereas you described yourself as one of those lost souls who's still groping.
That's me, groping in the dark. Yeah, I honestly, though, things have changed since I've become a father. My wife, Fontaine, was a performer. We have three children, 6, 3, and 2, boy, girl, and boy. And, you know, as all those listeners who are parents know, it's one of those transforming things. From the birth of my first child, Austin, I felt the presence of God in ways that I never quite did before. And, you know, I wasn't schooled in a religion. My father, went to Christian Brothers School in Louisiana, and Catholicism was a big part of his town and his family and his culture. And it wasn't where I grew up and in the time I grew up. And that, it does go back to that Flannery quote about, you know, the beliefs are not what we see, but the light by which we see. And I think my father's beliefs really shine through even the darkest of his character situations. And I think what I'm saying is mine is starting to change. I don't apologize for my previous, for my evolving view. The fact is, I do seem to be haunted by how wrong things can go. And I used to feel apologetic in my 20s, Terry, ashamed, really, of just sort of howling out in the dark and painting the darkness. But, you know, Flaubert said, too, that the last person to choose his or her subject is the writer. The writer doesn't even choose. I mean, you've just got to write what comes. But yes, there has been a real difference, and I think there is a real difference in our work, and I think anyone who reads both of us, if we didn't have the same names, I don't think anyone would ever put us in the same camp or even think of us at the same time.
My guest is writer Andre Debuse III. His new novel is called House of Sand and Fog. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Andre Debuse III. His new novel is called House of Sand and Fog. His father, the writer Andre Debuse, died of a heart attack earlier this year. Your father had been a Marine, and from what I recall of one of our interviews, that was really important to him and seemed to be an inspiration to him during his period of recovery.
That's true.
Especially early on. And I don't think that's an experience you had, and I'm wondering if you think that that was a fundamental difference as well, if there's anything that you wished you'd had of that Marine experience.
I remember being 19 at the University of Texas and seeing the boys in dress blues and wanting to jump in and do it because I was a real athletic kid and wanted to be tested in that way. At the same time, I was getting a political consciousness and knew that Marines had been used, frankly, for corporate gain. Nothing against the Marines. It wasn't their fault. So I was politicized and couldn't just leap in like that. But the fact is, this is not an issue for me with me and the difference between my father and I and our experience. He used to always say that my Marines was my bar fighting. And I have to put that in context because, boy, I can sound like a real blowhard talking about bar fighting and reactionary. But I do think that men in this culture, especially in working class neighborhoods, have to fight like dogs often. And I grew up in that area and at 15 or 16 began to fight back after not fighting back for years and fought for a long time. And it became a real problem. I mean, to the point where, I was never a bully and I never started fights with anyone who didn't deserve to have a fight started. Usually I'd kind of walk into someone who was beating up his girlfriend and punch him. And it was a weird self-destructive 8 or 9 years. But I had my own demons with masculinity. I know that my father has written about this and talked about this at length, that he joined the Marines because he didn't feel masculine enough and he felt he had to prove something to his father, who I never had the pleasure of knowing. And, I think it was very soon after his own father's death that my father quit the Marines. But see, one thing the old man did for me is never left me feeling that I wasn't a man already. I judge myself as being needing some strengthening, and I need to be more of a man. But I guess the long answer is I do think what you seem to be asking, Terry, is was there a rite of passage for me? Is that right?
Sure, yeah. And I guess I'm also wondering what the transition was between not fighting back and fighting back.
A terrible event. I just like a lot of kids, I was a new kid in town for years. I think I went to about 14 schools before I got to high school. And, as did my brother and sisters. And that's a hard life for a kid. And a lot of the neighborhoods were tough neighborhoods. And so for years, I just hibernated and hid inside my house. And my brother was beaten up very badly by a military policeman in the street with a whole bunch of people watching one day. And I didn't do anything about it. And I was 15 years old. And my self-hatred got to such a level, I couldn't endure it any longer. I would really rather be stabbed or shot than not fight again. And something really snapped. And I went on a rampage for about 10 years. By rampage, that's not the right word. I began to lift weights and take care of myself and stop eating Twinkies and drinking Coke. And I stopped doing drugs, which I was doing a lot of in the early 70s as a young teen, and cleaned up my act and really started to work on my body and then worked on self-defense and was surprised that I actually had boxing ability. And then I sort of set out to exercise that part of my life. And I put myself in situations, usually bar rooms, where there was always an opportunity to prove whether or not I had what I was hoping I had, which is the ability to fight when I was afraid. And which is, I think, at the core of us all the time. I think we're always afraid. I was always afraid. And so, I would wait until some guy hit his wife or pushed a little guy down or was just being inappropriate. Then I would step in and say something like, hi, can I have a glass of milk? Something to get him to insult me. And then I would go at it. It's terrible. I mean, but this is 15 years ago, and mm-hmm. It's something I had to do early in my life. And in direct answer to your question about the Marines, I think it was I had to build a little rite of passage. Not little, it was very significant for me and very frightening. And I had to design one on my own. And the problem is once you learn to break that membrane, that sort of psychic membrane between your fist in somebody's face, it's sort of something you have in a toolbox, which is a dangerous thing to have.
Right.
And it's important to learn, you know, to love actively without using that.
When your father was alive, did you show each other your writing before it was published?
Yes, we did. Absolutely.
And were you honest with each other? You know, it's hard sometimes when you're really close to someone and they give you their work. If there's mm-hmm. something that you don't think works, it could be hard to be honest. Cause,
yeah, you know. It really is hard to be honest. Honestly, there is very little my father gave me of his that I could say anything but, wow, Dad.
Right.
Pretty great. Can I go hide now and curl up in a ball somewhere? They're honestly, out of the 80, 90, I have to count now how many stories he wrote and published. I think it's close to 100 in his lifetime, in his career. There was one little story I didn't like, and I told him right off. And he wrote it on the plane on the way down to a reading, and it read like it to me. And it got up into one of his books, and I said, Dad, that one just doesn't work for me. But he always told me as well. But after a while, I didn't trust him because he was so effusive about my work. He believed in it so much more than I ever believed in my own. And I thought, oh, and also, when I became a father, you know, come on. I want to show people my son's poop. look how cute that little spit is at the corner of his lip. When I became a father, I really stopped believing him. Although it's probably unfair to him, but I thought, come on, he loves me. He's not going to tell me this is a contrived piece of crap I have to write over. You know, but we did. We showed each other after. Over the years, I've been defensive because people have assumed with the same name and having my father as a writer that, you know, he helped me. Well, no, he didn't. He helped me afterwards. If I had a draft done, I'd show it to him and show it to my wife and a couple of friends of mine whose opinion I respected, but my agent. But it was always after the fact. And more so for me, just I've been always been a fairly private, independent little guy. And, you know, a Virgo. So, you know, I never showed him until I was done.
I think one of the real dilemmas writers have, even fiction writers, is that if they're basing a character on someone who they know and who they're close to, and that person recognizes themselves in the story, that even if that person is transformed a lot in the fiction, that person can still be offended if they feel that they've been mischaracterized or described in a negative way.
Mm.
And I figure since your father was a writer, you might have been very sensitive to that because there might have been characters and stories who were loosely modeled on you, and you might have been sensitive about that yourself. I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's a good question. I was, and I do think it's the obstacle and challenge of so many writers that we, and you know, back to this point about imagination being somehow under siege right now in late 20th century America is, in my opinion, is I think I see that with writers with whom I work who will stop cold in their tracks a perfectly wonderful story because they're afraid of how their dead mother will read it over their shoulder. And that's a completely understandable fear. But I do think that the art has to go past that, and that the truth has to be illuminated in whatever way. And also, as you said, they are transformed. This is no longer your mother. This is no longer your father. You know, you based all those physical features on your living daughter, but because now it is in a work of literature and not life, it is no longer her. This alchemy occurs. My father did a very generous thing when I first began writing and publishing when I was 22. I sold my first story, and he called me. I was in Colorado at the time, and it was just so generous and so loving, and said, listen, you know, you're going to be a writer whether you think you are or not. And frankly, for 10 more years, I wasn't calling myself that, and I didn't think that's where I was going. And he said, just don't do what I did. Don't wait until we're dead before you write about us. He said, feel free to do it now. And I thought that was a really brave and generous, kind thing to say. And I took him up on it. But a year later, I wrote a story about, based on the day when my father left my family in divorce. And there was a scene there with the girl based on my little sister. And in the scene, she cries a little bit. I think I had phrased, she cried a little bit too. My father, after reading the manuscript, said, well, she cried a lot, actually. And when I said to feel free to write about us, I didn't mean to take me up on it right now. But, you know, yeah,
so
that happens.
Was he truly sorry that you'd done it?
No, he was. It just brought up, it was painful for him and painful for me. And but no, he just put it in its place and gave me a hug and said it was a good story and sent it out. He was very generous and very supportive. And I have to say, I'm not alone in this. I'm not saying this just because I'm his son. I do think he's one of the greatest writers in the English language of the short story, and his work's going to last a long, long time. And I never once heard him ever say an arrogant word about his own work. All the private moments, 39 years of private moments with him, never once ever heard him say anything arrogant or cocky about his own abilities or his own work.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
Andre Debuse III is the author of the new novel House of Sand and Fog. Coming up, a new CD paying tribute to Bill Monroe, featuring Steve Earle and the Del McCoury Band. This is Fresh Air. Steve Earle is best known as a rough-voiced singer-songwriter who works mostly in rock and roll forms with occasional forays into country. His latest release, called The Mountain, is a departure. It's a collaboration with the bluegrass group The Del McCoury Band and pays homage to bluegrass pioneer Bill Monroe. Rock critic Ken Tucker says the CD is an often deeply satisfying experiment.
Since you left me, baby, I've been true to you. I don't run around every gal in town the way I used to do. Starting over new, yours forever bloom. How about you?
The first time I played The Mountain, I just listened to it straight through without looking at the credits or the liner notes. I thought, boy, Steve Earle's really dug up some nice obscure bluegrass tunes. I've never heard any of these. Then I picked up the CD booklet and saw that he'd written every song on the collection. Well, this was pretty darn impressive. Listen to a song like Harlan Man. It thumps with the bedrock authenticity of a bluegrass tune from the 40s or 50s.
The music Steve Earle has written for The Mountain holds up as more than just a stunt, a CD-long salute to the bluegrass music that was virtually invented by fiddler and bandleader Bill Monroe. For one thing, Earle has altered the texture of bluegrass here. If you listen to a lot of contemporary bluegrass music, including the Del McCoury Band's own CDs,
It's most often very tightly controlled, precise music with crisp fiddle breaks and meticulously impeccable mandolin parts that lock into each other like the careful weave of the suits the performers wear on stage. What Earl has done is rough up the music a little, get it to sound a little more ragged and funky, more, dare I say it, rock and roll-y.
Work a graveyard shift, stay up all night long. Work a graveyard shift, stay up all night long. Wake up someday, find your good gal gone. If you don't treat you, baby, right, she'll come see me some lonely night. When the sun goes down, the moon's gone, that's when I come around. Don't you think I want on the graveyard shift, stay up all night long. Wake up someday, find a good gal gone.
That song, as I hear it, is as much influenced by Bob Dylan as it is by Bill Monroe, which is what I think distinguishes this collection from most bluegrass releases. Earl has also written himself a beautiful duet with Iris DeMent called I'm Still in Love with You. It's fascinating to hear this CD in the context of Steve Earle's career. He put out a couple of excellent singer-songwriter albums a decade ago, then went through years of trouble off and on with drugs and alcohol. In the past few years, he's had the ex-addict's addiction to work, putting out good music on his own label called E Squared, and pulling off a project like this. This is another sense in which I'll bet the discipline of bluegrass appealed to Earl. It kept him on the straight and narrow, even as he was taking bluegrass down some winding, crooked roads.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, and Kathy Wolf, with Anne-Marie Baldonado. Research assistance from Sam Adams. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I was born on this man a long time ago. For the night timber in the strip mine cold. When you rose in the morning, for it was light. To go down in that dark hole, come back up at night. I was born. She holds me, keeps me from worrying.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, publisher of Running on Ritalin by Lawrence H. Diller, M.D., providing information on the drug millions of children are taking, available in trade paperback. And from Book, the magazine for the reading life, covering books, authors, and the stories behind the stories on the shelf. Available at bookstores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, three doctors discuss their research on preventing heart disease. We'll hear about an amino acid that has been linked to heart disease, a bacterial infection that may cause it, and how emotional health may affect your susceptibility. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.